Well, I'm certainly glad to have the opportunity to meet you, because I read Superior Women back in July. I just got the hardcover copy, but I took this with me on vacation and read it, and also caught up on the other books. I especially loved the short stories. I just thought they were wonderful. So I was very anxious to talk to you, and I'm glad that Knopf has made you available to me.
I
feel as though I know a lot about your life, because I can... I'm
afraid you do.
yes, I can see you in a little cabin in Idaho, and I can see you down in a resort in Mexico. I can see you in North Carolina.
I've never been in a cabin in Idaho.
Idaho.
Did I say that?
Well, weren't you? Yes, you've set. I don't know if you have, but you've set some stories in a cabin near Lake Tahoe.
That's a very New York point of view. Lake Tahoe is in California, Nevada.
Yes. Right. That's right. I meant that.
I know. To you Easterners, it's all the same.
Well,
that's like the San Francisco people talk about Chicago as being the East.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about you before we talk about literature. And I know that you are originally from North Carolina.
Well, Virginia, actually. Mm-hmm. I was born in Virginia, but I grew up in North Carolina.
We had kind of an academic growing up.
Yeah, my father was a professor at Chapel Hill.
What was that like?
I don't think I much liked it at the time, but in retrospect, like so many things, it seems very nice. Very easy and quiet and pleasant. I didn't like the South when I was a child. I wanted desperately to live in New York. I thought that's where everything important was happening. Of course, I was quite right.
Mm-hmm. You were, indeed. How did you wind up, if you can call it that, in Radcliffe?
It was a desperate choice. I went to a boarding school in Virginia that I didn't like, and Radcliffe struck me as the most desirable escape from that school, and how right I was. I mean, Radcliffe after St. Catharines was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up in North Carolina, were there any indications that you would eventually become a writer?
Well, Chapel Hill is an extraordinarily literary town. My son went back to Chapel Hill on a sort of family errand for me a few years ago, and he came back and he said, "Oh, now I know why you're a writer." And I thought he was going to say something interesting, you know, dark family secrets unraveled. I said, "Oh, why?" He said, "Well, everybody in that whole town is writing a book." That's sort of like that. I mean, the message I got from the local air was that writing books was a superior calling. That's the best thing one could possibly do. You know, Thomas Wolfe had just been there. You know, I was growing up, let's face it, in the 30s, which was just post-Thomas Wolfe. Betty Smith was there. That's someone you've probably forgotten all about, but she was important then.
Betty Smith, Tree Grows in Brooklyn?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was the local heroine.
Yeah, I imagine she was after that book. When you were a child, were you writing?
Yeah, I was one of those really irritating children who writes poetry.
Ah. What were some of the themes that you touched upon as a child? Do you remember?
You know, sunsets, landscapes.
Stars?
Yeah, moons. A lot of stars and moons, you're right. Yeah.
Boys?
Seasons. Oh, well, boys, yes, quite early on, boys.
When you got to Radcliffe, did you start... I guess I should phrase it differently. Radcliffe, of course, plays a role in your novel, Superior Women.
Considerable.
Yes, absolutely. The young women that you went to college with, were there prototypes there of the women that you have written about in Superior Women?
Well, you know, as in all fictional characters, there were many prototypes. I mean, the actual characters with whom I ended up were combinations of a great many people. For instance, into the mouth of poor Lavinia, I put the words of every anti-Semite I met while at Radcliffe. I mean, I'm sure that no single person was ever quite so bigoted as Lavinia.
What happened after Radcliffe to you in your life?
Let's see, I had a minuscule publishing career in New York. In other words, I didn't last long.
And what is it? What happened?
I was fired. I was doing a rotten job. I mean, it was quite right. I thought that all that was really required was my presence, which they weren't getting a lot of.
This was a publishing house?
Yes, it was.
And what were you doing then?
Oh, I was some sort of... I was in advertising, which was a mistake in the first place. But I wanted to be in an editor, naturally, at 20.
Well, publishing, that's not unusual. Publishing is a very unstable industry, very cannibalistic at that.
Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, the week after the same company fired me, they fired Alan Tate. So I felt that I was in good company.
Alan Tate?
Yes.
Well, I bet they're sorry they did that.
Well, I hope they're sorry they fired me.
I did a series a couple of years ago called Looking for the Great American Novel. And I selected a young advertising man who had written a first novel. And what I wanted to do, he was probably not a good character for the series as I look back, because it was unusual. He was able to sell the idea, and he got a small advance right from the top. And most people who write their first novels don't do that. But I reconstructed the process of writing the novel from the inception to getting an agent to the publisher, to the writing process, to the printing process, to getting it into the bookstores, getting the reviews and everything, over a period of about 4 years. And I found as I began to reconstruct this process that nobody that he had worked with, none of the editors, none of the people who worked in the various publishers, he had two publishing houses, they'd all gone. And had gone
really?
To someplace else, or they had been fired. And I had to track them down. I had to track them at their new places. So I began to realize that I always thought broadcasting was unstable, but then I began to realize that the publishing industry is really unstable, and one of the reasons, I think, is that it pays so poorly.
That well, maybe everything's unstable. Did you ever think of that?
Well, yeah, I have.
I mean, maybe medicine is unstable if you're a doctor.
Well, you may be right. I'm not sure.
I couldn't be right. I'm just making hazarding guesses.
Well, you know, there's another allegation that people have, and they say that why are so many writers heavy drinkers and alcoholics? And I've wondered about that because I'm not sure that's the case. We know that James Agee was a heavy drinker, and Hemingway was a heavy drinker, and
To make a sexist remark offhand, isn't that more true of men than women writers?
What do you mean?
I mean, it seems to me that you find more true heavy boozing among male than female writers. I know a lot of really, really heavy drinking men writers, but I'm thinking of the women writers I know well. None of them drink a lot.
I know a lot of heavy drinking men, period. Many of them are commuters.
I'm just running through my list of women writer friends. I can't think of a real lush among them.
Well, I would like to have somebody...
And I speak as someone who loves wine.
Well, I've been known to touch a martini myself on occasion. But I just wonder...
I think it is... Well, I can certainly see why writers would drink. It's such a precarious, intense, tense, dangerous thing to do.
And they have to let loose somehow.
Sure. You're very lonely all day, and you're under tremendous internal pressure, which I think is possibly the worst kind.
Well, we're getting a little out of sequence because I want
to touch
on some of these literary things. It's my fault not organizing myself as well. But after your brief foray into publishing,
I got married. That lasted somewhat longer. I was married for 12 years. And
did you live here in New York?
No. We lived in Cambridge for a while and in Paris for a while, and then we moved abruptly from Paris to Palo Alto, which was a terrible transition.
Now, I could see there'd be a culture shock.
Oh, really?
Did you like it or not?
No,
like
I hated it.
Uh-huh.
Loved Paris, hated Palo Alto.
And yet you managed to stay in California all those years.
Well, I grew to like it. We spent another year in Portland, Oregon, and that was the year I fell in love with San Francisco.
Did your 12-year marriage cut into any desire to become a writer?
No,
did you have a desire to become a writer?
Yes, I always had a desire to become a writer, but that marriage kept me rather busy because my former husband was in graduate school and I had a lot of dopey jobs to support supported, which was what everyone in those days was doing. I mean, it seemed perfectly right for bright young women to be supporting their bright young husbands who were in graduate school. Although, of course, he also had the GI Bill at that time.
Were you writing stories during this 12-year period or not?
I was trying to. It's a period. Oh, and then I have a son. He was born during that period, naturally. So that, you know, that's sort of time consuming. I was writing, but it was desultory, and I didn't have a lot of time for writing. I wasn't very disciplined.
What happened at the end of the marriage?
Oh, everything improved. I began to sell stories, and my son cheered up. I'm not sure quite what you mean.
I'm just want to get a perspective.
No, that's
of
when
life.
I began to come more into focus as a writer.
Mm-hmm. You were turning out short stories.
Yeah, I began. Well, I sold my first short story when I was 32, and that gave me the courage to get a divorce. But I was operating on the totally erroneous premise that from then on I would sell every short story I wrote.
Didn't happen.
No, it's still of course not. It's still not true.
New Yorker published your first work?
No, my very first short story was published in a now-defunct magazine called Charm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that.
The New
that.
Yorker was yeah. quite a bit later, but I was always sending them stories. I wanted very much to be in The New Yorker. I used to send stories to The New Yorker when I was 18 and in college.
I think half the nation sends stories to The New Yorker.
Right. That's right.
I was, matter of fact, I was interviewing William Murray, who's was a fiction editor at the New Yorker for a number of years. He still writes the Letters from Italy column.
Oh, I knew.
He lives in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I knew.
He was responsible probably for turning down a lot of your stories, because he said he looks at them in a very perfunctory way. He admitted because
well.
They come in and they just come in like
yeah.
thousands and thousands, and he says after a while. You begin to spot things in the story, and you can make some fairly quick judgments. But I have a feeling that so many stories come in that the fiction editors or the screeners or whatever they are inundated and perhaps just can't take the time.
Well, my editor there now, Francis Kiernan, is among the most painstaking, kind, generous, living readers.
Is The New Yorker publishing most of your work now?
Yes.
Tell me about your
Happily.
First... Yes, for all of us. Tell me about your first book. How did that come about?
Oh, that was, unfortunately, a book called Careless Love. I wanted to call it The Fall of Daisy Duke, but my then-editor said I can't possibly publish a novel called The Fall of Daisy Duke by someone named Alice Adams. Now that I look back, that seems to me quite a ludicrous remark, because I really don't think the two names are similar. In any case, I didn't know then that you could talk back to editors, so he prevailed.
Who was the publisher on that for that book?
New American Library.
Mm-hmm. What was it like when you saw your first book? You came to you, I don't know, by mail or in an office or someplace, you picked it up and you saw your first book. How did you feel?
I felt, as usual, I felt both manic and depressed. The reception of it rather depressed. I liked the. I mean, physically it looked fine, and I was proud of it. I thought it was a funny book. I wrote it trying to be funny, but most of the reviews. I mean, it was received or perceived as a one more sexy divorcee novel, except in England, where everyone thought it was terribly funny and where it did quite well.
Mm-hmm. But that
was not my favorite experience. The publication of that book, I must say. And I think that's one reason it was so long before I wrote another novel. Because that book came out in 66, and my next one came out, I think, 74 or 5. I can't quite remember.
Because you felt unsettled because of the critical reception?
I thought maybe, yes, I thought maybe novels aren't for me. I might do better to apply myself to learning how to write short stories. I mean, it took about... 7 or 8 years to work up my nerve to write another novel.
You
but in that time, I was working hard at stories.
You don't feel the way you've now the way you felt then.
No, like novels.
Mm-hmm.
Especially very long ones.
Well, Severe Women's not that long, is it?
Well, it was long to me. I mean, it's twice
it's over 300 pages.
Well, it's in manuscript, it was over twice as long as any of my others. And when I mailed it to Knopf, it weighed 5 pounds. I think of it as a 5-pound novel.
Is there any difficulty living on one coast while the editor is on the other?
Really not, no. No.
But do you make revisions, or do you work with the editor closely?
Oh, very closely, yes.
Does she call, or he call, or no,
she,
it's a she.
Victoria Wilson.
Do they mail correspondence?
We do everything, yes, lots of mailing, phoning, you know. I'm not sure, I mean, except for, we don't obviously sit down and go over manuscripts together, but aside from that, I don't see that, I mean, I could just as easily be in Connecticut. No, I don't feel cut off from my editors.
There's a young woman writer who's written a first novel that was very highly received critically. Her name is Trudy Gertler. She wrote a book which lampoons the publishing industry called Elbowing the Seducer.
I wanted to read that. I read about it.
It's hilarious. You must pick it. Since you had a brief episode in publishing, you'll particularly be interested in this book. But when she was a little girl growing up in Florida, she would read the Miami Herald, and in the book section would always talk about the writer Faulkner, the writer Hemingway, or the black writer James Baldwin, or the woman writer, maybe a woman writer.
And Catherine Ann Porter.
She, yes, and Trudy Gertler said, why is it that everybody is categorized except men? Men are just writers, but then there are women writers and black writers and Hispanic writers. She said, I just want to be a writer.
Well, I think a great many of us have felt that, still do.
Do you find there's some critical discrimination in this regard toward women to this day?
Occasionally. One thing that I've noticed is that sometimes a male reviewer will choose to review what he takes to be the moral character of the woman writer as evinced by the usually sexual behavior of her heroines. Once someone was reviewing those short stories, as a matter of fact, and he said that it was really terrible the way that my heroines are always leaving nice men. And interestingly enough, the only story that he chose to praise was one in which I'd gone to some trouble to point out that the heroine of that story had been quite cruelly ditched by her husband. Well, he chose to block that from his mind and described her as a widow. You see, that being more acceptable to his thesis, that my women are flighty and sleep around. And what I'm saying is I don't think, conversely, that doesn't happen to men. I mean, you don't hear men writers being criticized for sleeping around or leaving women.
Mm.
As we all know, it's okay if they do it.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but Alfred Kazin, the literary critic and next-door neighbor of mine, was in. As a matter of fact, I have a two-part profile of Kazin on the air today and tomorrow. And one thing that he began to go into and kind of retracted because he thought he might get into trouble, but he felt that there is a lot of feminist writing today that he thinks is unkind to men, that there are many feminist writers, and I don't certainly include you in that category, but
I am a feminist.
Yeah, well, I don't consider you a feminist writer based on what I've read, but Kazin's complaint is that many female writers today are trying to do in men because they dislike men, and it's true. I do get the impression in some respects that men are pictured very poorly as heels and bums and just
not very nice people. I would entirely agree with that. I think one unfortunate Carl, that's not the word I'm anyway outcome of the feminist movement has been a sort of now let's get them view, which has led to a lot of mean-spirited and quite unconvincing pictures of men. One thing that amuses me is that occasionally someone will say of me, you know, she really likes men. Isn't that as though that were astonishing?
Well, I think you've said what Kazin tried to say, too, but was reluctant to say too much about it for fear of getting into trouble. But
no, I think men have been given a very bad press in the last few years, as it were. But I hope we're all getting a little tired of that.
Well,
men have feelings, too, right?
No. I do think that you portray men sympathetically in all of your books. Now, that Henry, for example, I can see you love someone like Henry. I don't know what model.
Sure.
He was based.
Well,
but at the same time, there are
for Henry, but I do love him.
I can't tell. You had so many references to his eyes behind those horn-rimmed glasses. But there are men in Rich Rewards. There was Whitey, who was a completely unacceptable young man. So there are men. Who are pictured unflatteringly, such as Whitey, but at the same time, Tony, hustler that he was pictured in a very nice way. So,
and then there's Jean-Paul.
Yes, well, yes, yes, another Henry.
Yes,
in effect.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that.
How did, tell me about your writing habits and how you go about putting together your work.
You mean what I do every day?
Mm-hmm.
I just sit down and write. I mean, I usually work on several things at the same time. I mean, I often have a novel and a short story going. Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm very disciplined. I mean, I just do that every day.
Punch in at 9 o'clock in the morning?
Well, not quite that early, but in the, yes. I mean, I regard it as a job.
What kind of working area do you have? Do you work in?
I have a room with not, you know, a lot of books and no view.
The view is distracting, I guess.
Well, I guess, yeah. San Francisco views are pretty glamorous.
Yes. You have according to the biographical material Knopf sent me, you have had a long relationship with an interior decorator. And I was going to ask, I didn't know that when I read the books, but I was going to ask you, because you had described a lot of houses in a very graphic way, and in Rich Rewards, of course, the heroine is an interior decorator. In one of the short stories, and To See You Again, you describe a house, I believe, near Chicago, which is very drafty. It's on a lake, I believe, and
oh yes,
very modern
yes.
house. That later, when a new family moved in,
yes.
they changed it around very nicely. In Superior Women, you have a house, I believe, it's in, I don't know if it's North Carolina or some southern
Georgia.
State. Yeah, where they're starting to remodel
yeah.
it and this sort of thing. So I was going to ask you if you had aspirations to become an interior decorator.
No, and I think the fact that I live with one is sort of funny. Actually, Bob is it's to him that Superior Women is dedicated, Robert McNee. He could more accurately be called an interior designer. I mean, because he designs rather than decorates. But I think from him, I have a new sense of houses and interiors.
You're teaching.
No, I have taught from time to time.
You're not teaching now, though?
No.
Uh-huh. Where did you teach?
I taught at Davis for a term, and then at Stanford again for a term, both of which were enormously rewarding. I loved it.
What's it like working with young people who wish to be writers?
Well, at Stanford, what happened was that I had a class full of 30-year-old hotshots. They were marvelous writers, but the really wonderful writer was 73. That she was a woman named Harriet Doerr, D-O-E-R-R, who later who was wonderful. The only thing to be said to Harriet was the one thing that she didn't know, which is, Harriet, you are marvelous. She was not enormously confident, but that worked out so well, because later, I don't know if you remember, a novel of hers was published called Stones for Ibarra, which did very, very well. Anyway, I can't tell you how gratifying that whole connection with Harriet was.
Was she working on that while you were teaching?
Yes, she was. Well, at that time, what she had were some beautiful, really perfect short stories, I thought. But she then went to Viking and got a very good editor who did it, sort of what Vicki Wilson did for me with my first Knopf novel, Families and Survivors. I mean, her editor, Cork Smith, pulled it together so that finally there was a coherent novel from a group of short stories, which, as I say, is what Vicki did for me. Anyway, Harriet was marvelous. That was an extraordinary teaching experience. I mean, I'm not going to get another Harriet Doerr in class.
How do you do it? Do the students write and then read their material?
Uh-huh.
Or
yes.
Do you go over it yourself or what?
Well, sure, everybody goes over it, and you know, everyone has copies, and then on a given day, a couple of people read their stories, and the class talks about them. The important thing to me seems to be to give everyone equal time.
That sounds kind of potentially scary for a student to have his story potentially ripped apart.
You'd be surprised. You can create an atmosphere in which that doesn't happen. I'm not sure quite how you do it, but I know that that's what I do, because I've not seen any ripping apart. I've really seen a lot of kindness and, to use a California word, supportiveness.
What's it like living in San Francisco? How long have you lived there now?
I'm so bad at numbers. Let's see, my son is 33. I've lived there about 29 years. I have to remember how old Peter was when we moved there.
Hmm. What's it like?
It's great. It works out extremely well for my habits. I don't drive, and it's a marvelous city for walking. I walk everywhere that I go. And as you know, it's physically very, very beautiful. It can be kind of boring. I don't think it would be a good city in which to live unless two conditions have to be fulfilled. You have to live with someone you like very much. I mean, you have to be centered in that way. And also you have to have some very satisfying work of your own. There isn't, for instance, in New York, I think you can be sustained just by the city. It's so exciting. But the civic life in San Francisco is fairly boring and third rate.
Boring? You've never lived in Toledo, Ohio, have you?
No.
You talk about boring.
Yeah.
Well, I obviously you like the restaurants because you always seem to make a point of describing the decor of the various restaurants.
Really?
That
you know,
your characters go through.
I guess I do like restaurants.
Yeah.
I like eating.
So, tell me about the literary community in San Francisco.
Well, that's another nice thing. There isn't one.
There is not one?
No.
No?
There are a few writers. For instance, as I told you, I see a great deal of Diane Johnson, who's enormously fun and rewarding and wonderful to know. And there are a few others whom I see. But there's not a literary life. I mean, there's not, say, a literary cafe or bar.
You don't hang out at the City Lights bookstore?
No. Nope.
Who do you like to read? Who were your influences, if you can remember, and who do you like to read now?
Well, when I was in college, I first started reading short stories. So, Elizabeth Bowen, Katherine Anne Porter. Now I like to read Diane Johnson, Joyce Carol Oates, Cynthia Ozick. This is always a hard question. I begin to think, I don't know, I've never read anything. And I go back and read Trollope for fun.
Well, you got one male in.
James.
modern male writers?
There's a new young man, David Levitt, who's a wonderful short story writer. I enjoy him enormously. Of course, I used to be crazy about Cheever.
David Levitt has a novel for Knopf?
It's short stories.
Yeah, I saw a nice review of that.
So good.
You ought to send me a copy of that. You know, I had seen some reviews, but that's his first book?
Yes. He's only, 21?
He's 23.
They're excellent stories.
Now, I didn't call Knopf to ask for it, because I had never heard of him, and I had no idea what it was, but I had read so many nice reviews that it might be interesting to do something.
Very, very good.
Well, Alice Adams, it was certainly nice having you in and chatting with me in this informal way. I enjoyed it, and I certainly enjoyed the books. And what are you working on now, if you can give us a preview?
I'm working on short stories. I have a collection coming out next fall. Yes, a year from now. So I'm writing more stories, and I'm thinking about my next novel.
Will you be back in New York next fall?
Oh, yes. I like to come to New York. In fact, I love to.
Try to time a visit. So you come back and to talk about your new book and short stories.
I'd like that.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. And how long will you be in town?
I'm leaving on Sunday for Paris.
For Paris?
For Paris.
Going back to the old haunts?
Some. And then drive around Brittany, which I've not ever done before.
You're not going to do the driving?
No, I don't drive. Bob is a marvelous driver.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, and it was very nice talking to you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it a lot.